loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Yulia Skripal, the daughter of Russian double agent Sergei Skripal, said at a press conference in the UK this morning that she hopes to return to Russia after her rehabilitation is completed following the nerve agent attack on she and her father. Meanwhile, the government of Theresa May has accused the Russian government and two alleged Russian intelligence officers of carrying out the attack. Next, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will host his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in in Pyongyang on September 18th. The scheduling of the meeting was immediately praised by President Trump and heartened observers who are looking for movement on the issue of North Korea's peace with South Korea. Then the Jerusalem Post reported yesterday that the Israel Defense Force had been arming Syrian rebels in an effort to keep them engaged in a fight with Iranian troops. The Post took the article down after a complaint by Israeli military censors. And then 8 demonstrators have been killed so far this week in protests in southern Iraq against corruption and inadequate basic services. This major unrest comes as the new Iraqi parliament convenes and heated negotiations to form the next government intensify. And finally, North Carolina's congressional districts have been found to be racially gerrymandered, but that isn't stopping state authorities from conducting one more election based on that district map anyway. Meanwhile, a federal prosecutor appointed by Donald Trump has issued 2 broad subpoenas seeking voter registration and other data from 15 million North Carolinians. Civil rights groups say the move is an attempt to suppress the Latino vote. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to the UK and the alleged poison gas attack on the Skripal family. Yulia Skripal, the daughter of Russian double agent Sergei Skripal, said at a press conference in the UK this morning that she hopes to return to Russia after her rehabilitation is completed following the nerve agent attack on she and her father. Meanwhile, the government of Theresa May has accused the Russian government and 2 alleged Russian intelligence officers of carrying out the attack. We're joined from Athens by Alexander Mercouris. He's the editor-in-chief of The Duran. Alexander, welcome back.
I'm delighted to be with you.
John, did you say that Yulia Skripal wants to go back to Russia?
She wants to go back to Russia. And she's been in touch with the Russian consulate in London. And she said that she wants to go back. She's a Russian citizen.
But Alexander, if the Russian government just tried to kill her and her father, would she want to go back to Russia?
Right.
Well, one would assume not. I mean, absolutely nothing about this story makes much sense. And I think one point I would make straight off is here we have Yulia Skripal apparently saying one thing. We have the police definitely saying something else. They go off and say that questions of guilt and innocence are to be decided by juries. That was what they clearly said in their statement, which got so much publicity. And then just a few hours later, Theresa May stands up in the House of Commons, says that these 2 people are not only guilty, but that they are GRU agents, and goes on and accuses the Russian government of being behind the whole thing. In other words, she throws the whole question of due process completely out of the window. So we're getting all these completely contradictory and, frankly, I think nonsensical statements coming out of Britain, none of which correspond with each other. And I really do wonder what's going on.
John, you were in the CIA for quite a number of years. This case just has anomalies.
Oh, many.
What Theresa May is saying is that these 2 Russian GRU agents got on a plane. I think it was Aeroflot.
Mm-hmm.
A Russian plane.
That's right.
And fly to London, rent a hotel, go around London where there's surveillance cameras everywhere, more surveillance cameras than anywhere in the world. Then they go and carry out the assassination attempt. And then the next day they head back together to the airport and take a Russian plane back to Russia.
Apparently using their real names and real passports.
Yeah. And so does this make any sense to
No.
you from an intelligence agent point of view?
Literally none of this makes any sense. First of all, as you said, they apparently got on an Aeroflot flight in Moscow together. They sat together. They arrived in London. They went to Salisbury, carried out this attempted assassination, went back to the airport together, got back on a plane and flew to Russia. None of that makes any sense.
How should it be done?
The way it's normally done is you would go separately, not on the national airline of Russia, and you would have passports in different names, preferably not Russian passports, maybe a Cypriot passport, maybe an Irish passport, whatever, whatever you can forge. You would get to London in different ways, maybe through Brussels or Paris or Amsterdam or whatever. You would never, ever travel together. And then if you're going to carry out your assassination attempt, you do that and not necessarily leave. You can go underground. You can hide out in a hotel. One of you might get on a bus and go through the channel to Paris. The other might get on a ferry and go to Ireland. None of what these guys are accused of having done makes intelligence sense. None of it.
Alexander, it doesn't make sense to me either.
No, and it doesn't make sense to me. And I think if I can just follow up on some of the things that I said. I mean, the obvious first step where there is a murder investigation, and I'm not somebody who knows much about the intelligence world, but I mean, I hear all that John says and it makes complete sense to me. But I do know something about how the way investigations happen, criminal investigations. And the obvious first step to do is for the British authorities, before they start bringing any charges against anybody, is to try to speak to these people and find out who they are and get their account of what happened. And the way that is done is you contact the Russian government and the Russian authorities, and you arrange interviews. And after you've interviewed these people, then you correlate what they've said with whatever other evidence you have. And then you make a decision about what you're going to do, whether you're going to prosecute or whether you're not going to prosecute. Now, there's no evidence that the British, in fact, we know for a fact that the British have done none of those things. As I said, we've had contradictory statements from the police, and Theresa May essentially has pronounced their guilt before they've ever gone on trial. And I'm going to say something else. The British government is actually being frankly dishonest when it is saying that the Russians cannot, in fact, are refusing to won't ever agree to extradite these people. The Russian constitution prohibits extradition of Russian citizens. That is by no means unusual. Lots of constitutions around the world do that. The British government knows that because a judge, a High Court judge, in a previous case, the Litvinenko case, actually said that. He actually said in that case that the Russian constitution prohibits extradition. The police, in their statement, accepted that. The British government ignores it and comes up with something completely different. So, I mean, as I said, it seems to me that what we're looking at here is a criminal investigation which has been run by the police, which has been hijacked by the politicians who are twisting it for their own particular political purposes. And the result is that the kind of questions that John was asking about what sort of operation this supposedly was are not being asked.
Yeah, Alexander Mercuris is our guest. The Russian government, yes, the Constitution says they're not going to, you know, it's against the law to extradite Russian nationals. But if the British government asked the Russian government to cooperate, to present these people, the British government could then conceivably go to Russia, interview these people, and make their argument. And I believe, if I'm not wrong, that the Russian government, if asked, it doesn't have to extradite them, would be, according, I think, even to Russian law, a force to comply with cooperating with the investigation. Now, the Russian government is offering the British government, in fact, insisting that the British government provide evidence so that Russia and Britain can work together on this case. And then we have Theresa May citing Russia's constitutional provisions against extradition as the reason for why they won't even ask for cooperation, even though the Russians are saying we're ready to cooperate. Go ahead.
Absolutely. I mean, the Russians, and I think it's an important thing to stress, they have offered cooperation. They have said that they are prepared to do all of these things, provided the British are prepared to go through the normal procedures in cases of this kind. And can I stress, it is not by any means unusual. It's not, the Russian constitution is by no means unique in this. The US doesn't extradite people. Israel doesn't extradite people. Russia doesn't extradite people. Some countries which have extradition agreements do. Britain never extradites people to Russia. There are many Russian criminals in Britain. Britain has consistently refused to extradite any of them. So, I mean, for the British to get on their high horse about this is wrong. And if they really wanted to get to the bottom of this matter, given that they are insisting, the British are insisting, that the source of this mystery is in Russia, then the obvious thing is to go to Russia, as the Russians are offering, and speak to the people there. Even if those people are lying when they speak to the British authorities, to the British police, you can learn an awful lot from the way people lie. And I think that is obviously what should be done. And what this says to me is that there's no real investigation going on, that, as I said, that investigation has been hijacked and is being distorted and manipulated for political purposes.
Alexander, we just have about a minute left. I want to play an audio clip from a press conference held by, well, including Victoria Skripal. She is the niece of Sergei Skripal, the poisoned British double agent, and she's the cousin of Yulia Skripal, also poisoned. She's talking about the UK not letting her visit to try to see her family, including Yulia and Sergei. She's speaking in Russian, and this is the voice of the translator. Let's listen, and then I want to give you 15 seconds to comment.
I'm not going to break any laws or any UN conventions. All I want is to see my relatives. Right now, I'm the eyes and the ears and the mouth of this 90-year-old woman, his mother, my grandmother. Just imagine, she's a very old person. Now we have to collect all her documents and apply for a visa on behalf of her. Yesterday, Theresa May said she had no complaints. She has nothing, no quarrel with the Russian people. Well, if that's true, why is she not letting me inside the country?
And the point is an entirely valid one, because, of course, what the British are doing, again, is that they're breaking up a family. I mean, we've heard so much about families being broken up. It is entirely appropriate that families should get together. Victoria Skripal is not a danger to Yulia and Sergei Skripal. Why are they not being prevented on meeting each other? Again, I mean, this is a complete violation of due process and of elementary human ethics. And I'm going to leave it at that.
Yeah, we're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Athens by Alexander Makouris. Alexander is the editor-in-chief of The Duran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will host his South Korean counterpart Moon Jae-in in Pyongyang on September 18th. The scheduling of the meeting was immediately praised by President Trump and heartened observers who are looking for movement on the issue of peace on the Korean Peninsula. We're joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. Tim's most recent book is Crisis in Korea. Tim Beal, welcome back.
Good to be back, man.
There's so much going on today, John. First of all, we hear from the two Koreas that they're going to meet on September 18th. Then we heard that from the South Korean military advisor that Kim Jong-un said he's never said anything bad about Donald Trump, and he wants to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula by the end of Donald Trump's first term. And then Donald Trump says Kim Jong-un and he are best buds. I have the tweet here. I'll look at it.
Yeah.
But then, like, minutes later, the Department of Justice announces that they've indicted a North Korean spy for the hack of Sony several years ago, which, I don't know, just the scuttlebutt around here, we're thinking, like, is the DOJ, is the FBI actually trying to do something to stop this even little...
Imagine.
Kind of momentum towards North Korean peace. Anyway, Tim Beal, a lot going on. What's your take?
Well, you're quite right about the DOJ. I mean, it's all tied up with this, the article in the New York Times, isn't it? Yesterday, the day before, and the Woodward book and so forth. The bureaucracy, the deep state, the stable state, I think one of them called it.
Steady state.
Steady state, sorry, steady state. Yes, yes, yes. Are out to foil any moves that Trump makes towards peace with Russia or with North Korea. I mean, reasonably enough, he's erratic, he's foolish. We know all these sorts of things. But we also have to realize what their agenda is, and their agenda, of course, is not peace. So I think this is probably how we would read the DOJ thing. I mean, it's obviously been in the pipeline for a long time. It's 177 pages, they say, and that's to make sure that no one actually gets around to reading it. We know that attribution of hacking is virtually impossible to really substantiate, and so forth. So I don't think we really need to worry too much about that side of it. As you say, it's the timing and the reason, the reasoning behind bringing this out is, again, another attempt, I think, to derail any progress towards peace.
John Kiriakou, it's classic Trump. And you can see, like, he has his enemies. We know he has his enemies in the media and in what some call the deep state, what the anonymous op-ed author in the New York Times, who says he's part of the Trump administration, a top official, who's also against Trump and hoping to end his presidency. He calls it the steady state. In that article, as Tim is mentioning, there are two things that the pro-Trump, inside the Trump administration, anti-Trump people, that's all one group, oppose in Donald Trump's policy is any warming of relations with Russia.
Yes.
And any peace deal with North Korea. Those are the consensus positions,
I guess,
of the now complete neocon establishment. But here's Trump, and this is so typical Trump. So North Korea says, we're ready to get it done. We'll have denuclearization by the end of Trump's administration. We have faith in Donald Trump, not from Kim Jong-un himself, but from a South Korean official. And here's what Trump tweets. Kim Jong-un of North Korea proclaims, quote, unwavering faith in President Trump. This is President Trump about himself. Thank you to Chairman Kim. We will get it done together. Now, I mean, okay, Tim Beal, I mean, this is the kind of talk by the CEO of the American state, the American empire, that makes his enemies feel like, okay, he can't be trusted. He's not a trusted warrior for the empire. He's reckless. But they absolutely don't want this to go forward.
Yeah, well, he's reckless, he's erratic, et cetera, but he's also fairly impotent because he's being shackled at every turn. We have the stories, I think, from the Woodward book of, was it Mattis or someone, taking papers off his desk so he couldn't sign them and things like that. So nobody trusts Trump. Kim Jong-un obviously doesn't trust Trump. But it's not merely because Trump's personality, it's also because of Trump's position and the, you know, and what the people around him can do. So the big question is whether in some way Trump can overcome this shackling of his power and achieve something. And that's the big question at the moment.
Right now, we don't know what will happen to Donald Trump. I mean, he might not win re-election. He might be impeached. He might be forced out of office. There's a lot of pressure that's growing, really intensifying here. Of course, Trump has a lot of support, too, within his base. And among some of the energy sectors, coal, oil, certainly the military contractors, it's a mixed bag here, but he's under a lot of pressure. Tim Beal, if Trump was not here, was not present, was not part of the scene, we'd still have Kim Jong-un, who wants to go forward, and we have Moon Jae-in, so we have North and South Korea. They want to go forward. They want to have normalized relations. They wanted to have a railroad that linked North and South Korea, but the U.S.-led UN command at the DMZ said no last week. My question to you is, Without Trump, will others in Washington, is there anybody else in Washington who favors a Korean peace process?
Not as far as I can see, no. No one on my horizon. You're close to the scene, and I'm not. But there's no one in the Democratic Party has come up and made any useful comments. I mean, the only people who really say anything on that line are the libertarians, aren't they? Rand Paul and people like that.
Yeah, but he's one senator out of 100. And certainly doesn't have executive power. You know, Lawrence Wilkerson wrote a piece back on August 28th. Lawrence Wilkerson was the Colin Powell's chief of staff, and he became a sharp critic of the Iraq War after he left the Bush administration. He said the essence of his article is that Washington has now completely adopted the neocon foreign policy orientation, which at the time of the first Bush administration was considered sort of an outlier ideological conception by one wing of the Republican Party.
Yes.
But now it seems to be the consensus, literally, except perhaps with Trump.
Yeah. I mean, yes, and this is terribly, terribly worrying. So we have this system in full flood. There's quite an interesting article by Nick Turse the other day saying that the military got itself into a position that as long as it kept on fighting and didn't actually retreat from anywhere, it was perceived as winning, and so the money would keep on flowing in. So it's a gift which keeps on giving. It's a self-reinforcing system, and all sorts of reasons beyond the mercenary behind that, the whole thrust of imperialism and so forth. But I mean, that's the state. Nobody in the elite, as far as I can see, actually wants peace. Doesn't mean to say they all want war, because war is very dangerous, but they certainly don't want peace.
Yeah. Tim Beal is our guest. Tim's recent book, Crisis in Korea, certainly a very apt topic. We hope people get the book. We're talking about the newest developments in the peace process, or the attempted peace process, the attempted normalization of relations on the Korean Peninsula and between North Korea and the United States. The North Koreans want an announcement of a peace agreement. They want an announcement that there's going to be an end to this war that began June 25th, 1950. There's only an armistice, so technically the war continues. The UN command, as I mentioned, led by the U.S. military, is at the DMZ. It still has operational control over the South Korean military. They want this war to end, and so does the South Korean government. And by all available surveys, the South Korean people support Moon Jae-in, at least in this part of his policy, which is to normalize relations with North Korea. The real obstacle here, and it's so interesting, Tim, and I want you to just, in our last 90 seconds, comment on it. Why, if the North Koreans are promising denuclearization and both Koreas want to move forward, what constitutes, or what's the reason for the obstinacy in Washington?
Well, as I said, Washington doesn't want peace, because don't forget, Korea is just a subset of the larger global problem of world hegemony and all that sort of stuff, and especially focused on China. So peace doesn't really fit into that. So they want to keep the military presence in South Korea. There's that very interesting quote from Mattis rebuking Trump, because Trump said, well, why do we need the military there? And Mattis said this nonsense about preventing World War III. He didn't mention China, but that's obviously what it's about. So we have to keep that in mind and think, in a sense, think China. That's what a lot of it is about. Think China, think Russia, and then Korea fits within that. And whether the Koreans can actually break through on their own initiative, coming together. Well, let's hope this summit next week moves things forward. But, you know, there's a limited amount that they can actually do. It's the Americans which hold the power. The American military controls the South Korean military, and so forth.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I thought it was disgusting, really disgusting, that last week the United States military told the two Koreas, no, you can't build a railroad linking the two Koreas. And of course, Korea was one people, one nation, one culture for thousands of years. Tim Beal is right, an absolute negation of the basic core concept of self-determination when it comes to the Koreans. We've been joined from New Zealand by author and professor Tim Beal. His most recent book is Crisis in Korea. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Jerusalem Post reported yesterday that the Israel Defense Force had been arming Syrian rebels in an effort to keep them engaged in a fight with Iranian troops there. The Post took the article down after a complaint by Israeli military censors. We'll get to the bottom of that with journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen, who joins us from Washington. You can see Dan's work at killinggaza.com. Dan, welcome back.
Good to be with you guys.
So, Dan, I Googled this before this segment, and I found articles that go back to 2016, mostly in the British press, sometimes in the Israeli press, saying that the Israeli IDF had been arming Syrian rebels. And in every article, it says they did that so that the fight would keep on going between the rebels and Iranian troops. That's not so hard to believe, right?
Right, exactly. That's been the strategy for years for Israel, is to just fuel the war in Syria in order to keep the bloodshed going, keep the Assad government weak, in order to help consolidate its occupation and colonization of the Golan Heights, which is it's been occupying since 1967 and is extracting oil from, and so it's a very deep project, but. You know, what the Jerusalem Post reported was actually reported. It's been reported before that Israel has been supplying our armed opposition in Syria. I mean, even ISIS has been, well, like the Syrian army has reported that weapons caches it's found in ISIS territory where it had Hebrew inscription as along with different Al-Qaeda groups. And so it's not really any secret. So the contents of the article that the Jerusalem Post published and took down at the behest of the Israeli military censor basically rehashed that, and specifically the reporting of the Lebanese journalist Noor Samaha, who revealed what's called Israel's good neighbor policy. And then actually the Wall Street Journal essentially copied her reporting about a week later, but this came out last year. And so this policy is essentially Israel has been funding a so-called Free Syrian Army group in the Golan called Knights of the Golan with about $50,000 a month to about as many as 1,000 fighters. And they've also given them light arms. And so this Knights of the Golan group essentially acts as a border force for Israel, kind of patrolling the fence that separates the Syrian, the Syrian-controlled Golan Heights from the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights patrolling against Hezbollah and the IRGC, the Iranian troops there. And so it's, part of this larger project to basically consolidate the occupation. But, as we know, this is not new information. So I think the real significance of the Jerusalem Post taking down this report is that it reveals the control that the Israeli military asserts and has over the Israeli press. You know, this article basically, which it was the Israeli military admitting what we already knew, was taken down after a very short time. And that's kind of the tip of the iceberg, showing, the depth of control that they assert. In 2017, I'll give some stats here so we understand how pervasive this is. Just in 2017, the Israeli military censor prohibited the publication of 271 articles, which amounts to more than 5 per week, and partially or fully redacted a total of 2,358. So, what does that say for the so-called only democracy in the Middle East, that it's really a military dictatorship, not only for Palestinians, but also for the Israeli press?
Yeah, Dan Cohen is our guest. Dan is a journalist. He's also a filmmaker, along with Max Blumenthal. He has made the movie Killing Gaza. And John, you said that it's killinggaza.com for people to learn about how they could rent the movie, look at the movie.
Don't miss it. I watched it when Dan first posted it, and it's quite powerful and very well done.
Yeah. So Dan Cohen, I'm looking at some other media outlets. The Israeli military has admitted that over the past year and a half, it's carried out more than 200 bombing attacks against Syria, inside of Syria. It always says it's against Iranians, but the fact of the matter is it's in support of these right-wing Islamicist-oriented political parties, including Al-Qaeda, who the U.S. says it's been waging a war against terror on since September 11, 2001. Israel, with U.S. taxpayers' dollars, about $4 to $5 billion a year, the largest recipient of U.S. military and economic aid, bombing the secular Syrian army government position and the positions of its allies on behest of these groups like Al-Qaeda. I mean, I don't think this has really sunk in very well with the American people, and I can see why the Israeli military censors, and as you say, it's functioning really as a military state, as a military dictatorship when it comes to media presentation. You can see why they just wouldn't be that excited about the people, the larger population, especially the population here, learning about this.
Right. I mean, you look at, you know, this that's a simple fact that Israel has I mean, that just, you know, came out in Haaretz 2 days ago, that Israel has bombed 200 different sites in Syria in the last year and a half. And that's like something like 800 missiles and mortars. And that's, you know, that's an uncontroversial fact, but it was a pretty big headline. And yet this myth that Israel has been, if you know, in the mainstream press in this country, in Western press, that there's this idea that Israel has been a bystander, has just sat on the sidelines of the Syrian war and, you know, hasn't intervened at all, when it's actually, of course, you know, very clear that it's been the opposite, that Israel has very much fueled the war and, you know, caused a significant amount of bloodshed and just prolonged it for no apparent reason, considering we see now that Israeli leaders are making statements that, you know, they will accept Assad in power. And this is, you know, a year ago, or they were, you know, during the liberation of Aleppo, they were saying, oh, he's a genocidal dictator and we should take him out. Open calls for assassination of Assad. And now the tune has changed because essentially, you know, Russia has asserted itself and Hezbollah and the Syrian army, but largely because of Russia coming in and saying, you know, we're going to stabilize this situation. But I think that also speaks to the culture of compliance in the Israeli and Western press that, you know, there's no military censor saying you can't say how many, you can't say that Israel has been an active participant in this war. It's just it's a total cultural takeover of Western press. And, you know, especially in Israel, where, you know, correspondents from the Jerusalem Post or Times of Israel, they're former soldiers themselves. That's where they started their journalism, or, you know, maybe you'd call it a propaganda career, as actual enlisted soldiers. And then they transition into, you know, civilian outfits where they essentially do the same kind of work and regurgitate military headlines according to the wants of the Israeli military.
Dan, in our last 2 minutes, I want to ask you about another issue that has been in the Israeli press the last couple of days. The Israeli Supreme Court yesterday upheld an order to raise a Palestinian Bedouin village in the West Bank. And this is despite international pressure. The reason this is important, this is the village of Khan al-Ahmar. The reason this is important is that it would essentially bifurcate the West Bank. It would cut it into two halves and make it that much more difficult for Palestinians to get from one place to the other. Can you talk about that?
Yes, exactly. This has been a long-term plan to completely separate the West Bank, the kind of northern half, and the southern half by expanding the East Jerusalem Israeli settlements of Male Adumim and Kfar Adumim eastward, basically to the Jordan Valley. And so Palestinians, so then it prevents the establishment of any future Palestinian state, you know, and just continues to drive a stake into the heart of this two-state solution, which, you know, the West has been a proponent of for so long and you know, of course, has refused to even consider the possibility of democracy in, you know, the entirety of the country. And so this little, you know, Bedouin village, which, you know, there's really not much to it. These are like small shacks. I've been to these villages. They're small shacks. It's, you know, not very big. There's not a whole lot to it. But the Israeli military will come in with, you know, hundreds of riot police in full combat gear and take bulldozers and just demolish the entirety of the village. And it's a really just horrifying scene. And so this time they evicted 180 residents. You can see the videos online of them beating women, dragging away, you know, men. And so, you know, that's the whole idea, is to separate, you know, further apartheid separation and entrench the, you know, settler colonial state.
Well, we will leave it there. We were joined from Washington by journalist and filmmaker Dan Cohen. You can see his work at killinggaza.com. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
8 demonstrators have been killed so far this week in protests in southern Iraq against corruption and inadequate basic services. This major unrest comes as the new Iraqi parliament convenes and heated negotiations to form the next government intensify. We're joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. Masoud, it's good to have you.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Masoud, these protests and demonstrations are interesting to me because they're not at all political in nature. They seem to be truly based on the fact that basic services are just not there: clean water, appropriate medical care, schools for children, and corruption. Corruption has been a big problem really since the U.S. invasion of Iraq. How do the Iraqis get past this?
Well, this is exactly what is happening, and these are all sort of the byproduct of the invasion and destruction of the whole infrastructure of Iraq, and indeed sort of creating these sort of hellhole. And it's not just Iraq. If you look at similar thing happened in Libya and indeed elsewhere, in Afghanistan and so forth and so on. Once you destroy this, this is what happened. But I will go even far beyond that. I mean, what was put together after the invasion itself was designed to create a sort of unstable situation. I mean, look at the constitution. I mean, right now, one of the issues between the political party is that the constitution is so unclear. No one knows who really has won. I mean, the sort of the two sides, which one under the Prime Minister Abadi and the other one, sort of former Prime Minister Maliki and Hadi Omri and others, they are arguing. On one side, the argument is that the leaders of these factions have actually given us their support, so therefore we could count all the MPs on our side. This is the argument of the Prime Minister Abadi and the Sadrs in one camp. And the other camp is arguing, no, we are counting actual MPs. And indeed, actual MPs, whatever party they are, we've got the majority, so therefore we should form the government. And the constitution is so unclear that actually creates this havoc. And this has been the sort of the reality of Iraq for a very long time. You know, the corruption on one side, the chaos out of sort of the constitution and the way things have been put together. And this is exactly why even Daesh managed to take over such a huge section of that country for in such a short time. And what people, ordinary people now coming in out in the street and demonstrating are saying enough is enough. And as a matter of fact, you know, the way they voted was also saying enough is enough. They didn't want to vote for the establishment because they have not resolved any of their issues, be it the sort of the infrastructure in Iraq, roads, electricity, water, and, you know, a very small group of people are becoming fatter out of the corruption and, you know, sort of working towards the creating the 1% in Iraq, and everybody else is suffering. And, you know, to the extent that even Ayatollah Sistani, not supporting the sort of the demonstrators, but sympathizing with them very publicly and openly, that what the corruption and the chaos have actually created the environment where these people are coming out. Having said that, there is also elements who, in any given circumstances, are going to take advantage of these sort of demonstration, and we have that element also there, sort of taking advantage.
You can't help but feel the great tragedy of what's happened to Iraq. You know, the first time I went to Iraq, Masoud, it was in December 1990, right before the first Gulf War, and I went with Muhammad Ali, the boxer. We went together. We were there for several weeks. We were making the argument that there should be peace, not a war, but nonetheless a war was coming because the U.S. had decided that they wanted a war. At that time, I was impressed with Iraq. I mean, even though it had just emerged out of the terrible Iran-Iraq war, the country was really flourishing. And, you know, just the whole thing about it, I was extremely impressed even at that time with the country. I went back multiple times in the 90s. The last time I was there was in 2002 in Basra, among other places, and I had gone there because we were documenting how the U.S. was bombing Basra and Mosul and every city every day. This was before the invasion of Iraq, and the economic sanctions had torn the country apart. And then in 2003, the U.S. invades. In 3 weeks, they knock out the existing government. They dissolve the Ba'athist army. And then Paul Bremer, the new colonial governor, not only ends the National Army, but rips up the existing constitution. And the Americans imposed this constitutional order on Iraq. They did this. They did it on purpose.
Absolutely. This is exactly was designed to create chaos. It was designed to make sure that Iraq is not going to be able to get back on his feet. You know, if you remember, Just after the war, the insurgents were targeting Americans. And then they put up a plan with the help of the Saudi. They diverted the insurgion into a sectarian sort of war internally to rip up the Iraq to pieces and not have and to have less opposition. And Iraq is, Iraqis who, you know, Shia and Sunni were living next to each other and nobody cared. Even in the Ba'ath Party, there was Shia and Sunni, and outside the opposition was Shia and Sunni. But now it's sort of the sectarianism has become a fact of life there. And this was, again, another design. It was designed so there will be chaos, there will be no ability to build the country back on his feet. And indeed, that has resulted a sort of a chaos, which Western companies are taking advantage of. They're coming and they're taking the resources away. And, if there is this sort of chaos continuation of it, it will be extremely ripe for the multinational companies to actually basically take advantage of Iraq without any ability of Iraq to be able to actually withstand that. And this is very sad. It's very sad to see one of the sort of powerful countries in the Middle East. Now it has become this sort of chaotic sort of situation, which unfortunately one cannot even see any way out of it. And this is why many of observers like myself are saying, well, we made a mess of it in Iraq. Why did we go and make a mess of it in Libya? Why did we want to do the same thing in Syria? And why is it that, you know, we are looking into Iran with the same sort of angle of looks. And you know, what do we want to do with Middle East? You know, the chaos.
It feels, Masoud, like the U.S. foreign policy. Yes, we were chanting no war for oil and things like that. And of course, Iraq's old constitution made it illegal for foreigners or even private persons to own natural resources like oil or the banks. But as you're talking and as we're looking back, maybe not just a war for corporate profit, but just a war that's kind of a wrecking ball designed to crush the regional players that actually had the population, the education, the military, the oil, the water, all the things necessary to function as a counter-hegemonic force within this geostrategically important and resource-rich part of the world. Just a wrecking ball, perhaps.
Absolutely. And you know, when you look at it, when you realize this is what is happening, and it's not just with Iraq, it's the same thing with Syria, same thing with Libya, then you see that it seems to be very clear that there is a plan to destroy anyone who's got any power in Middle East except the State of Israel. So the State of Israel becomes much more powerful in comparison to all its neighbors and the whole region. And this is really, it really is a very dangerous concept and very dangerous plan, if indeed this is what has been planned from the beginning.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from London by Masoud Shajara. He is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll take a break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
North Carolina's congressional districts have been found to be racially gerrymandered, but that isn't stopping state authorities from conducting one more election based on that district map anyway. Meanwhile, a federal prosecutor appointed by Donald Trump has issued two broad subpoenas seeking voter registration and other data from 15 million people across North Carolina. Civil rights groups say the move is an attempt to suppress the Latino vote. We're joined from Maryland by Drew Spencer Penrose, legal and policy director at the election reform advocacy organization, Fair Vote. Drew, it's been a while. Welcome back.
Thank you. Glad to be back.
Drew, you have expertise on the gerrymandering issue, so let's start with that. The courts have been clear, in my view, that the congressional district boundaries in North Carolina have been gerrymandered, that the gerrymandered borders are illegal and they need to be redrawn. But that's not going to change before this next election. Why is that?
So you're absolutely right about that. What North Carolina has is undoubtedly a partisan gerrymander. They have completely admitted to it, even in court. It was one of their early defenses against a claim of racial gerrymandering. We thought last year and this year that the courts might be willing to step up and hold that partisan gerrymandering actually was unconstitutional. After the Supreme Court sort of punted the issue in a case called Gill v. Whitford, North Carolina had to reconsider its case in light of that decision. And it did. It finally made its decision, said that they are clearly gerrymandered, said that we might need to consider redrawing them for 2018, but ultimately the timeline was just too short for them to do everything necessary to put in place new district lines. So as a result, we're going to be stuck with the same district lines, the same illegal, essentially, district lines for the 2018 election. It's kind of a disappointment. We at FairVote thought that there might have been opportunities. For example, they could have made the general election held by ranked choice voting so that they wouldn't need to use the primary election results. You know, when you use ranked choice voting, you only need one round of elections. You don't need two. A big concern there was that the primary elections had already taken place. So you could just nullify those and then hold the general election by ranked choice voting. But ultimately, the people bringing the case sort of backed down and decided, you know, that there's just no way that this can feasibly be done in time for 2018. So we'll see a remedy after 2018, fortunately, but for now, the 2018 election will continue under the illegal districts.
Real quick, before we go on to the other topics, help the audience understand ranked choice voting.
Absolutely. So ranked choice voting is a voting method where voters have the power to rank their choices. So you vote just like you do now for your first choice, but then you also have the option to list a second choice backup, a third choice, a fourth choice, and so on. Basically rank the candidates in order of choice. If a candidate has more than half of the first choices, they'll win just like any other election. But if nobody gets that majority, then you actually eliminate the candidate in last place. And if your first choice is eliminated, instead of being wasted, your vote will count for your next choice. And that just repeats until a candidate wins with a majority. So when you use that system, you can have more choices, you can express more on your ballot, and you still wind up with a majority winner without the need to hold, say, a second runoff election. That's completely unnecessary. So you get one round of voting instead of two. That's the timing benefit that I was talking about with North Carolina.
So if you were in a toss-up state, a disputed state, uncertain about the winner, and you voted, your first choice was Jill Stein or a socialist candidate or a libertarian, and your second choice was, let's say, the Democrats or the Republicans. If your candidate comes in last, then your second choice counts.
That's right. You don't need to worry about what's been sort of pejoratively called the spoiler effect, which is to say a candidate participating who you really like, you believe in their vision, but you don't think they're actually one of the front runners who's going to win. In a vote for one election, you'll probably be encouraged not to vote for that person, to instead vote for what people call the lesser of two evils. In a ranked choice voting election, you don't need to worry about that. You can honestly rank your first choice and then rank your backup choices as necessary so that if there is that kind of vote split going on, the ranked choice voting count actually resolves it without any need for strategic voting on the part of the voters.
You know, I never heard of that system until the last time we had Drew on the show. And when he explained it, it made so much sense to me. It's so much more democratic than any other system we have going right now. I'm wondering why everybody's not doing it.
Well, we might see everybody doing it before too long. We've seen a really tremendous surge in energy around this issue. In 2016, Maine became the first state to adopt it for its state and federal elections. We saw it used in Maine's primary elections. People coming out of those elections said that they felt good about ranking their choices. They felt confident in it. They voted at the same election to keep ranked choice voting for the future. Five cities have adopted ranked choice voting and will be implementing it over the course of the next few elections. That's in addition to the 11 that are already using it regularly. So this is an issue that has real energy. And, you know, it might not be too long before when people think of voting, what they think of is ranking their choices.
I want to switch over to this issue of voter registration. The U.S. attorney who covers half of North Carolina, at least, has issued these two subpoenas asking for millions of voting records. This is the voting records, and it's more than just voting records, but information on some 15 million people across the state.
And he submitted it on behalf of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement.
Correct. ICE. Not specifically on behalf of the Justice Department. This was done for ICE. And here's what he's looking for. Registration application forms, postcard applications, federal write-in absentee ballots, early voting application forms, provisional voting forms, absentee ballot request forms, any record of voter cancellations, and any form on which someone admits or denies being a non-citizen. So this, to me, this just screams racism. That it's an effort to target Latino voters.
Scare them.
And to scare them into not voting, even when they're American citizens and clearly eligible to vote. Am I seeing this the wrong way, Drew?
You know, there are a few elements to this. So you're right that there's sort of part of the overall sort of crackdown on immigration status approach that we've seen from the Trump administration, and this is all consistent with that. From the voting perspective, there's two things really going on. There's the suppression angle of it, which is to say how many people are going to be worried that they'll be unfairly targeted. They're eligible to vote, they're citizens, but they'll be unfairly targeted if they attempt to vote. And on the other side of that, there's also the legitimacy of the election itself. So we heard a lot of talk after the 2016 general election. One thing was Donald Trump lost the popular vote. The most votes in all 50 states actually went to Hillary Clinton. And one way that he pushed back against that was by claiming that there were millions of illegal votes. Now, nobody who's looked at the issue thinks that there are nearly that many illegal votes, but delegitimizing an election result is a tactic that people will sometimes use. And it's really a pretty disturbing one. And it's really the whole thing's connected to each other, because when we've got a system as antiquated as the one that we do, it becomes easier to delegitimize election results. Not as many people feel connected to the people that they successfully elect as they should. And all of these elements that serve to disempower us and sort of diminish the effectiveness of our democracy really go hand in hand. So although I actually personally don't do a lot of work on voter registration issues or voter suppression issues, I focus more on the voting method, the sort of structural side of things. I do see how all of this is really deeply interconnected.
Yeah, John, we're about out of time, but I just want to remind our audience a show we did last week. There are thousands and thousands of Americans. They were born in the United States. They have Latino surnames.
That's right.
They live in the South for the most part. The Justice Department and the other agents of the U.S. government are actually denying them passport renewals on the basis that they have to prove by going back and finding medical records from when they were born, sometimes 40 or 50 years ago, to prove that they actually truly are American citizens.
And outrageous.
So it has the effect of sort of creating fear within communities, particularly Latino communities. Somebody might be a citizen. Their brother maybe is not yet a citizen.
Right.
And so they don't want to draw attention to the family. They see the ICE is taking control over their voter registration. So instead of voting, there's just like, let's go back to the shadows.
And you know, one of the infuriating things about this too is if you look at sheer numbers, there are more people of Chinese origin who are in the country without documentation than there are Latinos. But we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from Maryland by Drew Spencer Penrose. He's legal and policy director at the election reform advocacy organization Fair Vote. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio and also at Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. See you next time.
Loud and Clear.